David Mathis versus Positive Safety Manufacturing Company. Attorney Quest, you're going to introduce Attorney James R. Brannett. Has Mr. Brannett been motion for pro hoc vici been granted yet?
Your Honor, the motion for pro hoc vici was granted in the County Circuit Court. We have not made one formally in this court.
And now you're making one.
I am making one.
Okay. Counsel, would you go to the microphone and make your motion?
Your Honor, Eric Pless of the Everson Whitney Everson and Bream Law Firm in Green Bay. I move the court for admission pro hoc vici of James R. Brannett of the Bolero and Carton Law Firm from Chicago on behalf of our client, Positive Safety Manufacturing Company.
Thank you, counsel. You are admitted for purposes of this case and counsel for this court.
Thank you, Your Honor. James Brannett on behalf of the defendant appellant, Positive Safety. May it please the court. I'd first like to address what I hope is an uncontroversial issue, and that is there were two amendments to section 895.045. The first merely added the sentence that the negligence of the plaintiff shall be measured separately against the negligence of each person found to be causally negligent. And the reason that is uncontroversial is that it merely codified long-standing case law. All the way back into the 1930s, this court has interpreted the predecessor of the current statute as requiring that sort of separate measurement of the plaintiff against each defendant or each person who could be found to be causally negligent. And in fact, the court has applied that very same rule for decades, even in the context of a strict liability cause of action. For example, in the Collins versus Eli Lilly and the Dipple versus Siano case itself, where the court adopted the idea of strict liability, it recognized that this would apply even in the context, or that the statute would apply in the context of strict liability. And even more specifically, Your Honors, the negligence of the plaintiff must be measured against both the manufacturer of the product and any causally negligent employer. The court has found so in both Held versus Nicholson and Conar versus West Shore Equipment. So, and in fact, I think that Mr. Matthews' counsel has agreed that on the special verdict form in this case, both the employer and Positive Safety must be listed, and the plaintiff's negligence must be measured separately against each of those. And the only reason that this is raised is more as a matter of prudence, because the trial court in this case said that all of the amendments, the 1995 amendments to the statute, were unconstitutional. And I think that it's incumbent upon the court to clarify that the first sentence, with the addition of the sentence that the negligence of the plaintiff shall be measured separately against each person found to be causally negligent, is not, in fact, unconstitutional, because it is not even possibly a retroactive application. It is, in fact, merely codification of longstanding case law. Rather, the meat of this case is on the second issue, which is rather the second amendment to the statute. And that amendment provides that the plaintiff shall not be able to recover from a defendant found to be less than 51% at fault any more than...
So you just switched a word. Switch from negligent to at fault.
Well, Your Honor, it's talking about causally negligent and negligent.
No, but why in a products liability case are we talking about causally negligent? You switched because the cases say at fault for contribution purposes.
Correct, but that is the equivalent. And in fact, in some of the cases, well, causally, you have to be a cause, and you also have to be negligent in order to be at fault.
No, well, then how do you get to that with product liability? It says when you instruct the jury that it's not, you don't say negligence. You say it's a duty to manufacture a product that is not unreasonably dangerous. You don't ask the jury, were they negligent?
No, not in those many words, Your Honor. That's true. But in the Dipple case, this court did find that strict liability is a species of negligence. It is another way of proving negligence, an equivalent to negligence per se.
Sort of like res ipsa loquitur?
Exactly, Your Honor. It's just another...
Exactly. So is it equivalent to absolute? Is it equivalent to absolute liability?
No, it is not equivalent to absolute liability. There still has to be some fault found, and that fault will be the sale of a defective product. So it's another—it's a different analysis, but you end up in the same point in the framework that this court has set of finding negligence and causally negligent.
Well, do you really? I recognize that you say in a contributory negligence that the plaintiff, the user of the product, has to have taken due care for its own safety.
Correct.
Therefore, when you say, give an instruction then, saying was the plaintiff, the user of the product, did he use or she use, did she use an ordinary due care for safety? Because even if the other person is absolutely liable, strictly liable, strict product liability or negligent, you can still cause your own injury. And therefore, that should be weighed. I don't have any problem with that. You do have causal negligence. But as I read the cases, they don't talk really about, they compare the plaintiff's negligence with the product's safety. Isn't that the first question?
Well.
Or a question, I should say. And then, they do a comparison of all the defendants, named or unnamed, for purposes of contribution.
Well, I have two responses. First, Your Honor, the question of plaintiff versus product is, strictly speaking, not an issue in our case,
okay,
because
so
we do not have a chain of distribution issue. But the second point is...
So what is it in the... Plaintiff versus product, what's the liability potential here? That is, what is, would you say, plaintiff was X percent negligent? Oh, was the plaintiff here going to be over 50% negligent? Because if it is, then that's the end of the case. I know it hasn't been tried yet.
Correct.
But is that possible here?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what...
Well, let's just say, in this case, the plaintiff is 25% negligent.
Okay.
Right? Didn't pull it out of the box correctly, didn't handle correctly, right? So that they weren't...
That's the...
No, I'm sorry. I'm on the other case. in terms of that, but you could find the plaintiff negligent here.
You could answer if you can.
Sure. Yeah, I don't want to tread on the toes of the other counsel.
But I'm trying to get how you're going to do it under the new law.
Well, I don't think it is new law because it is, first of all, certainly even in a products liability case, you are finding whether you can find the plaintiff to be negligent. You can't allocate, even in our own case,
right,
in the Matthews case, that the plaintiff was negligent.
Yeah, because they weren't handling the machinery properly.
Correct.
Okay. How's that on your machine?
Just as a follow-up to that, so I get the concept, and I'm going to plug in the jury instruction in this concept, but you have... is plaintiff versus the product. The question is, in a strict liability, in a product's liability case, you have the issue of whether or not the product was defective, whether the product caused, so you have causal relationship there, and then you measure the negligence, contributory negligence of the plaintiff, vis-a-vis the cause of the product. Do you agree with me?
Well, I think.
And then I have more to say. I just want to know if you agree with me.
Yeah, I think that part of that you've collapsed two issues into one. The question is the plaintiff versus, it's not plaintiff versus product. Each member of the chain of distribution is at fault for selling a defective product. So there is a question, well, is there a defective...
I'm getting to that. Let me just be more specific. Question number one, what was the product defective when it left the possession of the seller? Question number two, was the defective condition a cause of the plaintiff's injuries? Question number three, was the plaintiff negligent? Question number four, was such negligent causal? So you have the product, was it defective, was it causal? You have the plaintiff, was the plaintiff negligent, was it causal? Then you have the fifth question, which is comparing the plaintiff with the product. Now, you agree with that so far?
I agree that those are the jury instructions, okay. Your Honor.
Then you have, in this product's liability, in this strict liability, then you apportion the liability of the defendants with regard to the defectively causal product. Is that correct?
Yes, that's one way of approaching that issue. But...
Is that the correct way under our current law of approaching the issue?
That is an approach that I think that the courts, the lower courts, have interpreted City of Franklin as requiring. That is correct. I don't know that City of Franklin actually dictates that approach. I agree that that may be a legitimate approach, but it requires a more insightful analysis of the issues of strict liability.
Well, since Franklin, what is Franklin, a 73 case, if I remember correctly? Since 73, would you agree, and then the subsequent jury instruction that came out after that, that that's the way that the law has been applied in this state?
I agree that that's the way that it has been applied according to the jury instructions.
So but it's about 26, 7 years.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think that this court itself has said that that is required.
And I understand that. In your brief, you argue that maybe the City of Franklin had a different gist, if you will, but you agree that for the last 27 years, the way that I have just stated it is the way that the law has been applied in this state pursuant to those jury instructions.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, I just want to switch gears here a little bit and just talk about the retroactivity and the fact of the due process argument that is raised by opposing counsel. I want you to address the relationship that this case has as to the Martin or the Neiman case and indicate why you think that you don't have basically the same problem in this case that you've had in the cases that I mentioned, particularly the other side is arguing, I think quite persuasively, that you're taking away a right of recovery and that this should not be made retroactive to them.
Certainly, Your Honor, that is the heart of the case. I want to get to the center of the heart itself, and that is the balancing test in Martin and Neiman, where you balance the public interest or public purposes versus the private interest and how they're affected.
Counsel, I know that's what you want to get to, but we don't get to that if we buy your argument that this statute is not retroactive. Correct?
That would be correct also, Your Honor.
So could we address retroactivity first?
Sure, I certainly can. The difference between this and Martin and Neiman in terms of the retroactivity is the triggering event. And I think the Chappie opinion from this court, and as well as all the other opinions discussing retroactivity, look at the triggering event to determine whether a statute is going to be retroactively applied. In Martin and Neiman, we're talking about valuation, or we're talking about the amount of damages that have been incurred. The damages are incurred on the date of injury. That's the triggering event. You are damaged to a certain amount on that date. So consequently, any law after that date would in fact be retroactively applied because it occurs after the triggering event. In this case, we are talking about application of the a modification of the joint and several rule to a jury verdict. The triggering event in this case is the rendering of the jury verdict itself. In other words, the change in the law may have no effect at all. In fact, in most cases, it will not have any effect.
Well, counsel, I guess I don't understand your argument, or I'm not persuaded by it. In Martin, on the date of the injury, she assuming that you could foresee on the date of injury that she was going to have all of these resultant costs, in any event, there was no cap. And as it turned out, injuries were about $2 million. And if we applied the cap to her, she'd only be able to get $1 million.
That's correct.
So she lost about, if this was applied to her retroactively, she'd lose about $1 million. Well, in this case, as I see it, and tell me why I'm wrong, Mr. Matthews, on the date that he was injured, if the jury verdict was to come in, 45%, if he was only 10% negligent and positive safety was 45% negligent or some figure like that, he'd be able to collect all of his damages from positive framing. Let's say those damages were $200,000. Whereas here, if we apply retroactively, Mr. Matthews is only able to collect 45% of that $200,000 less his own negligence. That seems to me to be on all fours with Martin with respect to his loss.
The difference, though, the distinction was actually stated in your own question. You said, if the jury finds.
Mm-hmm.
That is a necessity. That contingency has to come to pass for the difference to occur. If it never comes to pass, there is no difference. It's a future contingency. It occurs only after the jury renders a verdict. That itself is the triggering event. If you leave out your question, if the jury finds, then there is no difference between the before and after statutes.
Okay, I'm going to rephrase the question. Maybe I'll get this. Litigant comes to you, gives you the fact situation of your case before passage of this law, and asks you, what are the possibilities in this case? You are going to tell them, well, your damages are going to depend on what your injuries are, and your injuries now, and then they may increase over the years, but that would be okay, and you get recovery. And then they say, well, who can I sue, and who am I going to get recovery from? And you say, well, you can sue everybody that's connected with this. And if you find any of them liable, you can recover from that person and any other person in this chain. That's your, under the law, that's your right, even if it's a 1% liability under this contribution, but you can recover, right?
Well, you can certainly
tell them.
No, I wouldn't, Your Honor, because you could certainly obtain a judgment, potentially. Now, that even in when you're talking about a case in advance of the trial, I would always, of course, caution the client that there may be an issue of fact as to whether a defendant might be immune as an employer or as a co-employee or some other aspect.
But the immunity is going to be the present law at the date of injury, right?
Correct, but that doesn't mean it's a certainty at the time that the client comes to me. So that's always a caution. Another caution is this defendant may go belly up. He may go bankrupt, and we may not be able to recover anything from him. So those, again,
the date of death of the injury or thereafter.
Correct. It is not until the verdict is actually entered that it is becomes a certainty. It's only at that point that there are no more contingencies left.
Well, there are no more contingencies as to damages after the jury verdict, too. Before that, you can't even tell them what the damages are going to be.
Yes, that is correct, but you can have a best estimate, and that's done every day where insurance companies and so on settle.
And you have a best estimate as to who the defendants are and what their potential liability is.
Can I follow up? Let me follow up with the Chief's hypothetical. You're sitting in your office. You're a plaintiff's lawyer now. And the client comes in on June 1st with this set of facts. Mr. Matthews comes to you on June 1st, and you have knowledge that the legislature is going to consider and probably could take a, and probably pass these amendments on June 15th. Do you think you'd be bound to, would you have to tell them we better get this case filed before June 15th?
I would hope I would say that.
Yeah. Why?
To help avoid the application of the change in the law. I would have that opportunity just as existed in this case.
So, Mr. Matthews, I think your answer then, implicit within your answer, is that Mr. Matthews has a lot to lose if he doesn't file before June 15th. Potentially.
I'm not denying that if certain contingencies occur, that he will potentially lose part of a cause of action, or part of his recovery, I should say. He will not be able to collect the full amount of his judgment should certain contingencies occur. But we don't know when those contingencies are going to occur until later.
Counsel, when I was reading your brief, I looked at the statute that we're dealing with, the whole issue of retroactivity, and it's your position that it is retroactive. Is that correct?
Well, I don't. It's not retroactive in the sense that has been discussed in the Martin and Lehman cases, primarily because of our argument that the triggering event occurs after the enactment.
What bothered me is this. I took a look at the statute. I took a look at the history of the statute in Wisconsin. And in 1931, we had a sea change with regard to this statute. Before 1931, if you were a plaintiff and you were contributory negligent at all, you were barred from recovery.
Correct.
In 1931, we changed that, and we said that if the plaintiff couldn't be more than 49%. Negligence. In other words, not as great as. And then we had a case that dealt with retroactivity of this statute, and we said that it's not retroactive, and the triggering date is the date of injury. And we go along for about another 40 years, and we have another sea change in 895, the statute. And then we talk about in 1971, not greater than the whole 50-50 thing. And we have a case right on point that says, is it retroactive and what's the triggering date? And we say, it's not retroactive and the triggering date is the date of injury. Now we have another sea change 24 years later. But you're standing here and wanting us, with this third sea change, to not follow our precedent. How do you get around the Holzen case, which was a result of the 1971 change, which cited the Brewster case, the 1931 change?
The difference is it's just a matter of statutory interpretation, Your Honor, not constitutional law. In both of the cases that you're talking about, the statute did not have the sentence it has now in the 1995 amendment that it shall apply to all actions filed after its effective date. It is that sentence itself which makes the difference between this case and the prior two cases.
The sentence being again what?
That this statute shall apply to all actions filed after its effective date.
So we're supposed to take a look at the way that we treated the legislation in Holzen, the way that we treated the legislation in Brewster, and there were several other cases at that time, and treat this one differently.
It is treated differently because there are different facts. There are different statutory provisions involved in each. It's just a straightforward application in each case of statutory interpretation.
The general rule is that if you're just changing the procedure and it's remedial, it applies to everything filed after that date. So if you're going to move the filing from the clerk of court to the county clerk or Madison or whatever, you view it as procedural and it's effective immediately. If you say 10 copies instead of 3, it's immediate. But the general rule is that substantive changes, that is, changes of substantive issues, are not retroactive and can't be because you're going back and changing a person's rights. So how do you fit it into that kind of argument? And your argument is going to be what? These are not rights.
Well, there are two steps to it. One is joint and several. The history of it is, if you look at Prosser's discussion of joint and several, it was a matter of procedure originally. Rather than requiring a plaintiff to name all the defendants, he could just name one. This is very akin to a plaintiff being able to name a union, for example, an unincorporated association, in its own name, rather than having to name all the members of the union. That's a procedural rule. But the second point is the one that I think is more important, and that is, in Neiman, this court said, even if it is a substantive right, even if it's vested, that's not conclusive. You still go on and do the balancing test. You still go on and weigh the public purposes versus the private interests. And that's what makes this case different than Martin and Neiman. The public purposes, I see my time is up.
Go ahead, finish.
The public purposes are ones that this court has already recognized in the Bilski versus Schultz case as being important and fair and more equitable. And that is basically the basic goal of the law of negligence is the equitable distribution of the loss in relation to fault. And this court itself has even said it's difficult to justify, and I'm paraphrasing, either on a layman's sense of justice or on natural justice, why a joint tortfeasor who is 5% causally negligent should be required to pay 100% of the loss on behalf of a co-tortfeasor who is only 95% negligent. So you are, by adopting this rule, the legislature was basically trying to extend the application of the basic an equitable rule of law that this court itself tried to apply in Bilski to another context of tort law. And the important point about that is that in this case, that public purpose not only justifies prospective application, but it also justifies retroactive because that purpose is in fact achieved to all cases filed after the effective date. It is achieved when the statute is applied retroactively. I could go into the details, but I know my time is up, so I just want to quickly say in Martin and Neiman, the public purposes, this court found that the public purposes were not achieved retroactively. But here in this case, I think we've demonstrated that they have been.
Justice Babbage has a question, Counsel.
I know we took up a lot of your time, so I'm going to try to paraphrase what I think is your basic case here, and you tell me where I'm wrong or where I'm a little bit off. Seems to me that what you're saying is that this statute is not retroactive. because of the arguments that you made. And because it's not retroactive, there are no due process implications. But if it is retroactive, and there are due process implications, then the standard of review saves you because the public policy outweighs the private interests. Is that a summation of your...
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Burnett?
May it please the court, I'm George Burnett and I represent David Matthews in this case. Let me start my argument with the last point that Mr. Brannett made. Mr. Brannett said that essentially this court's decision in Bilski versus Schultz at 16 with second page 1 controls this case because there this court determined in allocating contribution among tortfeasors that the allocation would be changed and the change would essentially be retroactive. Their argument is that if that was the rule in Bilski, that should be the rule that applies here. And my short response to that point is that this court was very careful in Bilski to make a distinction between the law of contribution and the law of contributory negligence. At page 6 in the Bilski case, this court said, "We make it plain at the outset, this refinement of the rule of contribution does not apply to or change the plaintiff's right to recover against any defendant tortfeasor the total amount of his damage to which he is entitled. Likewise, we point out that Section 331.045, which is one of those statutes that preceded this that Justice Bradley was referring to, has no application to the doctrine of contribution. So the short response is that this court recognized in Bilski that these two concepts are very, very different.
Well, in keeping with that, if I might, Mr. Burnett, I've already shown I'm having a hard time keeping these two cases separate as to facts, and the other case does raise the issue of the application, but wanted to get it when there was a switch from negligence to fault. Was it in this case that the company is arguing you have, in effect, don't have any right to that kind of claim because you didn't raise in the Court of Appeals the issue of the application of this statute at all? Yeah, it's this one. Mathis is barred from raising the issues of equal protection and whether 895.045 applies to strict liability actions. This is his fifth point on double two, that is. And the circuit court ruled against you on these issues and you didn't cross appeal. That bars further consideration.
Let me address that. I think that...
Yeah, let's get it out of the way.
Right. I think that there's a claim in the Fuchsgruber case that the constitutional issue was not raised below. There's a claim in this case that neither the product's liability or the equal protection arguments were not cross-appealed from. The short answer to that question is my understanding of Wisconsin law is one must appeal from orders, but you need not appeal from theories. Second, the premise is wrong. Judge Poppe, if you review his decision, found or alluded to equal protection in rationalizing or explaining his decision here. So it's my position that Judge Poppe, although the analysis was short, said that equal protection has been violated as well. And in a related vein, he never got to the question of whether the statute applies to product liability.
My assumption is this was a motion, the motion to dismiss was denied, so it was in your favor, and you didn't have to cross appeal, except if you, because you don't want to modify that order denying it.
That's right. I thought I won.
Theory.
I mean, it was that simple.
Okay. I guess that's why you called respondent.
The let me also try to address the question that Justice Bablich was raising about whether this legislation is retroactive. I think Positive Safety essentially argues that this case is retroactive because there was no judgment against Positive Safety.
Is retroactive or is not retroactive?
Positive Safety saying this is a prospective claim. And I think that issue is disposed of in both Neiman and in Martin. In Martin, the statutory language, the effective date of the statute's language was different, but in Neiman it was identical. Here the legislature says this applies to causes of action that are filed after such and such a date. Neiman, they said the same thing. This court went ahead in Neiman and disposed of that issue in paragraph 11. It said, there is no dispute on the issue of whether the amendment to 895.04 is indeed retroactive. It is. The legislature provided that the act first applies to actions commenced on the effective date of this subsection. The language indicates the legislature intended to include the scope of the within the scope of the amendment those claims in which the events giving rise to a cause of action had already occurred. That's our case. Thus, in this case, we need look no further to conclude that the legislature intended 895.04 sub 4 to be retroactive. So I don't think that there is any sensible way to distinguish Neiman, especially from this case. Another argument that's been raised that there's really no substantive constitutional right at issue, that this is simply a matter of collection. That too is addressed in the Martin decision, and I won't quote from the case extensively, but I would simply notice that in Martin we have the exact same sequence of events. We have an act of malpractice. We have a new law that changes the right to damages. We have a verdict, and as a result of the new law, we have less than the full damages awarded. This court held in Martin that that is a substantive constitutional right that is protected under Wisconsin constitutional law.
But in Martin, as you just pointed out, we had a verdict.
Yes.
So we knew what the damages were.
Yes.
Here we don't have a verdict.
We don't have a verdict only because of the procedural posture of the case. This was brought as a declaratory judgment motion. But the important point in this case and in Martin is we have a change in the law, and then eventually we will get a verdict, and then if that new law is applied to the verdict, the damages will be reduced.
Well, not necessarily.
Only
if
in the
event... If the safety is found 51% negligent, then it's not. Isn't that one of the hearts of your opponent's arguments?
Yeah, and both parties decided early in this case that before trial, that this matter should be resolved by declaratory judgment. This was their motion for declaratory relief, and I don't remember if I moved for the same relief, but I certainly supported the judge reaching the decision. And the reason we did it is because I think we both recognize very clearly that this is a case where the employer may well be more than 51% at fault. And that's why we are here now.
Well, if we had a verdict in which it was 50, in which positive safety was found 51% or more, would we be here?
No.
Okay.
We would not.
Well, go ahead, please.
Mr. Burnett, 895.045 applies to all kinds of different actions. Certainly actions that don't involve workers' compensation. This whole matter does involve some workers' compensation. Could you discuss 102.29 and whether that has any special impact on the statute?
This 102.29 has a very special impact on this case and many cases where this statute is applied. And I would respectfully suggest that it fits in the analysis and analyzing the effect on the private interest overturned by this retroactive legislation. The best way to do it is probably by a numerical example. 102.29 goes by a formula. You take the verdict, you reduce it by a third plus costs for the lawyer. You then take the next third, and that award goes to the plaintiff. Then the workers' compensation lien is paid, and then the balance goes to the plaintiff, but there's what's called a cushion that essentially is the workers' compensation carrier gets a credit for any future medical or disability expenses that needs to be paid. So if we take this case and go through the math and assume there's a $500,000 verdict, if this law is retroactive and you assume that there's a 70-30 split where the employer's most negligent and about $15,000 in costs, Mr. Matthews will net at the end of that case where the law is not retroactive about $125,000. With $100,000 workers' comp lien going to the workers' comp carrier and $175,000 to counsel for fees and costs and that type of thing. If you assume the same verdict, 70-30, with the same workers' compensation lien of $100,000, but positive safety is only responsible for 30% of of these damages, Mr. Matthews will collect $30,000. And the reason for that is because the $500,000 award is reduced right off the bat by 70% for the employer's negligence. So it's now a $150,000 judgment. So Mr. Matthews has paid once for the employer's negligence. But then he has to take his 30%, and he has to repay the employer's insurance company again. So essentially he's answering twice for the employer's negligence.
Would your argument be that because of that effect, the statute is unconstitutional as applied, or is unconstitutional altogether?
I don't think the court needs to reach the question today as to whether it's unconstitutional altogether. I have raised that issue as a component of our equal protection claim, but I would note that this court, I could not find a case where this court analyzed retroactive legislation under the equal protection clause. So I think this court's holding can be narrower, and I think this court can essentially say that this retroactive application of the statute in combination with 102.29 makes its effect on this private interest especially disruptive.
Oh. Indeed, it is the interplay between 102.29 and the 102.03, the exclusive remedy of the workers' comp provision, that makes your client and clients in your clients, rather, in people in your client's situation, treated differently. You know, there's a lot of, it seems to me.
That's exactly.
I'm wrong. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about there is no right to full recovery. You agree with that, don't you?
I do.
But it seems to me that your argument is that your client, and actually clients similarly situated, do not have the potential for full recovery because of the interplay between this statute and Chapter 102.
That's right.
102.03 and 102.29, is that correct?
That's right.
And so it isn't just a matter of full recovery. They are denied the potential for full recovery. As a matter of laws, the matter of the interaction of these two laws, they will never be able to get full recovery, regardless of the circumstances of judgment proof or bankruptcy or anything like that. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Mr. Burnett, it seems to me that this case may well come down to the final arguments put forth by your opponent, which is taking a look at this statute and determining whether the public policy interests outweigh the private interests of Mr. Matthews. I'd like you to put on Mr. Brannett's hat for a moment and tell me what you think his best public policy arguments are, and then answer them with not only answer that they're not important, and then also put forth what you believe are the private interests of Mr. Matthews that override these public interests.
Let me, I don't want to be in a position of putting words in Mr. Brannett's mouth, but I think what Mr. Brannett's argument did is essentially two things. It said there are a lot of public goods that the legislature pursued by enacting this change to the joint and several law. He mentioned fairness, making a defendant pay only what his fair share is if he's less than 51% at fault for the accident. He mentioned similar things. The fallacy in that argument is that this court's cases in both Neiman, and Neiman's especially important because that's where the court undertook this analysis, is the focus is not on the goals of the legislation or the goods the legislation produced, but the focus is on what good comes from this because it is retroactive. And that's where there is really a paucity of reasons. We have very, very few. As a matter of fact, there's really just one that I could see in the briefs, and that is it's easy to apply. And the response is, well, it's no easier to apply than calling the date of injury the date the statute should should begin to apply. As a matter of fact, I think in the Quinn case, the Bradley case, and the Keeley case, this court reviewed this type of legislation, tort legislation. I think those were all wrongful death cap cases where the legislature did just that. It said the date of injury is what measures this, and then Bradley, just as a tangent, I think the court had to analyze what happens when the injury occurs before the law changes, but the death occurs after. So that's a long way of saying, I think the only public policy argument mustered in this case is the ease of application. The response is, number one, it's no easier to apply than a date of injury, and number two, it has the added benefit of not discriminating between similarly situated people. Had Mr. Matthews had a coworker and both were involved injured in this accident, his coworker sued before the law changed and Matthews sued after, you have two identically situated people who are treated very differently under this law. There is no public good that comes from that.
And are you saying that the only private interests are the opposite sides of those claims, the ones that you referred to?
The private interest is threefold. First of all, it's the fact that in combination with 10229, this particular law is especially onerous on a man like Mr. Matthews. Second, in Martin, this court said that it is always suspect when the legislature acts to place the burden of tort reform on the catastrophically injured, on the backs of a few. And that's what's happened here. In Martin, it was a non-economic damage award of $2.25 million reduced to $1 million. Here, Mr. Matthews has lost much of his left hand. And it's beyond the record before this court just what effect that has had on his life, but it has been significant. He has been, he's one of the few people who must bear responsibility for this retroactive change in the law, and that's not fair. The key question here is...
What's the third?
Let me check. The third is a species of the first, which is really he's forced to assume the employer's responsibility twice. And this court's analysis in Neiman said one of the fundamental questions is this fundamental? Answer your question.
I'm still troubled by the fact that we don't have a verdict here, because if in fact if we had a verdict that said positive safety was 51% or more negligent, we wouldn't be here, as you said. Because then it doesn't matter whether it's retroactive or not, because Mr. Matthews would still recover the full extent of his injuries, correct?
Yes, and that really goes to a question of rightness. I mean, are we,
right.
Is this an appropriate matter for declaratory relief or not? And what I can say is that the neither party has raised that issue, as a matter of fact.
No, he seems to raise it implicitly, hasn't he?
I don't think so. It was his motion to seek declaratory relief in the first place. And from a practical standpoint, both sides needed to know what the answer to this difficult question was. The circuit court thought it was appropriate, and I don't think the Court of Appeals indicated any such issue in its certification to this court.
See, it seems to me that what Mr. Bennett is saying is that until we know what the verdict is, that we can't answer any of these questions because it's not retroactive. The effect of retroactivity is nil, and that there is no due process implications.
I, I didn't read that in his briefs or...
Because he says that the time of... the cause of action accrues not at the time of injury, but it accrues at the time of judgment. Because we don't... And maybe I've just completely misunderstood his argument, but we don't have a date of judgment here.
I think he is saying that even if we go to judgment and Matthews gets a judgment for 30% against the employer, and then we bring this case back, he's still going to take the position he's not lost anything of constitutional value, because his right accrues at the time of judgment, not at the time of injury, and that's an argument this court has rejected three times recently in the last 5 years in Neiman and Martin, and then I believe in the Noel case as well, back in the 1980s.
But this court still has to speculate in an area that this is a major difference between the Neiman and Martin case that in private interest we're talking about. We don't know what it is because there is not a verdict.
Well,
so it could be, as Justice Babich indicates, something completely different.
Well, we know the extent of Mr. Matthews' these injuries, and we know that they are very significant, and we know that both counsel think it's likely the employer is going to be significantly at fault for this case. So I would be very surprised, just as a matter of course, if the employer was not more than 51% at fault here. But you're right, I don't have a judgment that I can look to that says that.
So the wording of the statute shall apply to all actions filed after its effective date is right. I mean, that's
really the key.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Burnett, could you say a couple of words here about the fact that the statute was published on the 16th of May and took effect the next day, and you're claiming that doesn't have notice? I mean, how serious are you about that?
I am serious because of this court's comments in Martin, and in an earlier case, Swankey. The Swankey case spoke with great hesitation about whether a 49-day notice period would be adequate, but never had to reach that issue for unrelated reasons. In Martin, this court, as part of its analysis of the private interest, the fairness of the retroactive taking, as the court put it, said the cap was, we believe the manner in which the Martin's rights would be impaired by the cap is inherently unfair for two reasons. Then they go on to give the first reason. The cap was published one day and it became law the next. Without any meaningful notice, the Martins were stripped of their right to unlimited damages because they did not file on June 13, 1986, the date before the announced cap became effective. And the court goes on to say that that type of legislation is a
What is the rule that you'd want the court to announce about the effective date of statutes?
I would announce a rule that would be limited to retroactive legislation. If the legislature, for good and substantial public policy reasons, wants to make a statute retroactive, then it must give a fair amount of notice to people between the time it passes the law and the time it becomes effective.
That's a fair amount.
Well, I think Swankey indicates it's more than 49 days. So, I think that's a legislative judgment.
Mr. Burnett, I have some difficulty when I reread Acre and reread Martin of figuring out what this court's principles are as to retroactive application of laws to injuries occurring before the date of the law, whatever that date is. maybe you could help me in, from the outside perspective. Give me a summary of what you think are enduring principles that this court has set forth that we can then apply with consistency to other cases.
As I read Aker and Makos and the various decisions in Makos, I think the guiding principle now out of Aker is that the if a statute leaves some remedy and does not bar access to the courthouse door, then it does not run afoul of the remedies clause. That and all.
It doesn't run afoul of what?
Of the remedies clause, Article 1, Section 9. As I read Aker, I think the historical analysis that Justice Prosser went through essentially amounts to that. But I would say that in this case, we have entered somewhat of uncharted waters, because in Aker is a passage that said the legislature may not change the law as it exists. So it is speaking, as I read it, to retroactive legislation, although in Aker I don't believe the statute there was retroactive. So we now have a question of whether or not by changing the remedy as it exists at the time the injury occurred, does the legislature run afoul of the remedies clause? I think that is much of what Justice Crooks was writing in the Makos concurrence. I think Justice Crooks was saying that if the legislature changes a right that existed before our Constitution, or a right that it created after the by statute, then it must leave an acceptable alternative remedy or have an overwhelming public purpose for leaving a litigant remedy-less. I think that's how I would harmonize those two line of decisions. But
you're talking about Makos and Aker, not
about
Aker and Martin. Yes,
right.
The Chief mentioned Martin.
And the difference between Aker and Martin, I think, is simply a difference about what prong of the Constitution you're analyzing. Martin's a substantive due process case and never hits the remedy clause and never hits equal protection, although I think both issues were raised there. Aker is a remedies clause that touches upon equal protection and touches upon substantive due process, but doesn't analyze it from the standpoint of being retroactive legislation. I think that's probably my best answer to your question.
Thank you, counsel.
Is that your final?
Thank you.
Thank you. Brent?
Justice Babowitz, with all due respect to Mr. Bennett, I think I'd rather have you restating my positions than him. I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said that because there's no judgment here, this is not a retroactive application. It's not an issue of ripeness. It's a question of whether it's retroactive. The triggering event just hasn't happened yet. The statute has no possible application until that triggering event occurs, and consequently it cannot be a retroactive application.
But then why? Okay, no. But then you brought the motion, correct?
Well, we brought a motion to declare that the statute applied to the strict products liability action. Mr. Burnett brought a counter motion to declare it unconstitutional. So we did not seek a declaration that it was constitutional. I mean, that would be presumed.
Mm-hmm. But you want it applied even though you don't have a verdict. You want a decision.
Correct. Primarily because, I mean, at the initial stages of this appeal, it looked like it would affect what the special verdict would look like. Now that's been cleared up by Mr. Burnett's concession that the employer has to be on that special verdict as well.
Well, isn't that the old law, that you would have put that employer on the special verdict?
Yes.
Could you discuss the interplay with the workers' comp law?
Yes. That is a troubling aspect of the interplay between the two statutes. But this is, an issue here is, again, whether the statute is, or amendments are constitutional on their face, not as applied. It's purely contingent whether that interplay will even come into play at all. And that actually is a response to Justice Bradley's assertion or comment that it's not even a potential right to recover against the employer, or not even a potential right, but full recovery. That's actually not correct. Again, if positive safety is found 51% at fault, the plaintiff gets a full recovery. So he does have a potential for full recovery, even if an employer is involved. So this is an interplay between facial constitutionality and as applied. And we're not looking at it as applied. We're looking at it on its face. But the more important thing, though, Your Honor, is in terms of the effect, the hypothetical effect that Mr. Burnett has raised. The legislature itself has already done the balance. It has balanced the interests of employees, employers, third parties, and they've come to the conclusion that the scheme that they have in place should be the one that exists, that there should be an absolute bar against a tort action against the employer, that there should be no recovery against the employer, and that the employer should be able to recover its lien even if it is at fault. This court in the Mulder case has already declared that that is constitutional. So that's not even an issue. If you don't consider that aspect of this case, it is our position that 895045 is also constitutional. So the question then becomes, well, can the interplay between them cause one or the other to become unconstitutional? Again, I don't think that can be addressed in this particular case at this particular stage, but even if it could, I think that the fact that the legislature has done the balancing itself dictates that this court find that it is constitutional, because this is not the place to reweigh those interests. The legislature itself is uniquely qualified to weigh those interests. And the most important thing to realize about this is, in fact, that all that's happening is that plaintiffs injured by multiple tortfeasors are now being treated exactly the same as plaintiffs injured by single tortfeasors, who, in this case, who are employers. A plaintiff injured only by the employer recovers nothing other than workers' comp. A plaintiff injured by multiple tortfeasors now is in the same position. They cannot recover against anybody the damages attributable to the fault of the employer. They're placed in the exact same position, and consequently, in fact, that is what the legislature is doing, is placing all plaintiffs on an equal plane rather than giving a preference to plaintiffs injured by multiple tortfeasors.
Well, if the plaintiffs, plural, are injured with an employer who has liability, I get back to my earlier concern. Any plaintiff injured with a workers' comp interplay with an employer who has 51, who's mostly liable, doesn't have the potential for full recovery. Everyone else injured has the potential for full recovery. Not that they'll get it. You know, I agree with you. There is no right to recovery. I'm talking about the potential. But anytime you have an injured party who has a plaintiff employer liable at least 51%, their potential for recovery is unlike anyone else's.
That's correct. That's the application of the workers' compensation statute that this court has already been found to be
constitutional. Well, it's the application of the workers' compensation statute as it interplays with this 895045.
But it's also, even if there are multiple defendants, if an employer is found to be 100% at fault, even though the plaintiff tried to establish a case, the result is the same. everybody is in the same position. They can't recover the damages attributable to the fault of the employer.
So when can this, you indicated that maybe the statute could be unconstitutional as applied. When could that happen?
Well, I don't think that I said that it could be unconstitutional as applied. I just pointed out that that whether it is as applied is not an issue yet in this case.
Okay, well, let's make it an issue. When could it be unconstitutional?
Well, I don't think it ever would be, because as I stated, that it is actually only placing all the parties, including the plaintiffs and the defendants, on the same plane. Again, joint and several liability is the flip side of the coin of the transition from contributory negligence bar to a modified comparative negligence bar, where now the plaintiff can recover according to, or is barred from recovering only according to its own degree of fault. I see my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Thank you, Mr. Brannick. And then,